The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
In 2006, Bakari Sellers defeated a 26-year incumbent state representative to become the youngest member of the South Carolina state legislature and the youngest African-American elected official in the United States. He currently heads the strategic communication and public affairs team at the Strohm Law Firm in Columbia, South Carolina, and works as a CNN political analyst. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, My Vanishing Country. He joins us this evening with his new book, The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward Now. Please welcome Bakari Sellers to the Free Library.
I see what you're talking about, man. Good evening. Good evening. I am from the big city of Denmark, South Carolina, where we have three stoplights and a blinking light. And my mom and dad would always tell me that the two most important words in the English language are the words thank you. And they're not nearly said enough. And so first I want to thank the Free Library for having a good old country boy from South Carolina be here with you all today. And I also want to thank all of you all because I didn't realize that the Nixon 76ers game started right at 7:30. So yeah, let's get through this. And so yeah, you'll get back by the middle of the second quarter, I promise you. I have to thank my good friend Dan who's here. He's a lawyer with me. We're working on a case here involving the MOVE bombing. Yes, that is still being litigated here. As a civil rights lawyer, we'll talk about some of those things. And we'll have an opportunity to play pundit. We have questions and answers. I'm going to speak briefly, and then everybody will have an opportunity, if you so choose, to ask me any questions you may. I am only 39 years old, and so I haven't been in politics yet long enough to lie to you. And so please ask me anything you want. And last but not least, I tell people this when I speak often, that this evening I'm going to treat all of you all like Elizabeth Taylor treated all seven of her husbands. And that means I'm not going to keep you long, right? I'm so excited and thankful that all of you all are here. Yesterday morning, I was in Birmingham. We had about 300 people in Birmingham, and last night we had 280 people in Baltimore. And I'm here with you guys in Philly, and then tomorrow I'm in D.C. Sunday, I'm in Charleston, South Carolina. Thursday in St. Louis, and Friday and Saturday in Chicago, and then we actually do some stuff in L.A. and Atlanta. But just having people come out and be a part of your journey means a great deal to me. And so I have to simply say thank you. The Moment was a book that I interviewed Cicely Tyson on a Monday on my podcast, and she passed away on that Wednesday. And you know how people coined the term black excellence and or black girl magic. I think that if you had pictures in dictionaries, her picture would be beside both of those terms. She was the most beautiful woman that I'd ever been around in my entire life. And she asked me, well, I asked her the question. I said, Mrs. Tyson, you're over 90 years old. Why are you writing an autobiography now? And she said, because I was waiting to have something to say. The Moment was this type of book for me. I have written My Vanishing Country, which I'm thankful to some of you all in this room, was a New York Times bestseller. And I wrote Who Are Your People, which is a children's book, because I know y'all are city folk, but particularly the black folk in the room, I know y'all are city folk, but all your grandparents are from South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, etc. I'm just letting you know that. And when we see you on the street in the South, you know, we might get your name first, but usually the second question we ask people, or who are your people? Because we want to know who you are. You related to the dude who, you know, steals every now and then, or shows up drunk to church, or, you know, who are your people is the question we ask. And I was able to write a children's book to be able to teach young people about their history and their legacy. My story is unique, and it's something that is ingrained in every piece of writing that I have. The moment was about a moment in time that for me was a time period where this country could have been something that she ended up not being. This book starts actually with two moments or three moments that I recall from my perspective. The first is a picture that I talk about, and that picture is after my father got arrested. He was arrested for protesting apartheid in South Africa. And he was arrested for protesting apartheid in front of the South African embassy in New York. And there's this picture of my dad and Jim Foreman and John Lewis. And in the picture has Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier. And the picture is so powerful because it encapsulates a time where you had this interesting cross segment of intelligentsia, wealth, popular culture, entertainment, and grassroots activism, all trying to search for those words that we hold so true, like justice, freedom, and peace. And it begins with this conversation that my dad and I are having about really the two sentences or two questions that encapsulate this book and my life, questions that I ask myself often, which are, how far have we come and where do we go from here? My father is very clear in his assertion that he believes that we're back in 1954. And that is a damning assessment of where we are as a people, because my father has seen his good friend, Dr. King, be shot, killed. I joke with my father, he doesn't find it funny, but whatever, that Dr. King didn't get everything right. And Dr. King performed in the basement of Ebenezer Baptist Church, my dad's first wedding that lasted 6 months. But my dad also lived through Jimmie Lee Jackson and Medgar Evers and Emmett Till. He lived through Samuel Hammond and Delano Middleton, Henry Smith. My dad lived through his own being shot on the campus of South Carolina State University, February 8th of 1968, along with 28 others in what's known as the Orangeburg Massacre. And three young men were killed. And for him to give that assessment of where we are, it starts the book with a jolt of reality that there is this push and tug about a true analysis of how far we've come. I disagree with my dad's assertion that we're back in 1954, although I think objectively he's correct. Black home ownership today is at the same place that it was pre-Fair Housing Act of 1968. The clear, tangible metric by which we can delineate wealth in this country is home ownership. And it tells you something when those rates are back to where they were almost 20 years before I was born. But I push back against my dad and say that, no, that's not quite accurate, because I believe you have to give all of those heroes and heroines who paid what Abraham Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion their due. Those people who bled, those people who were arrested, those people who were shot and killed. Because what I don't want to be is in a position whereby we say that their lives and struggle were in vain. And so I deduce that in this country, we've made a great deal of progress, if we're intellectually honest. We still just have yet a ways to go. And I parallel that. When I write with characters in mind, because what I like to do is anything that you read that I may put my hands on, I like for you to learn something that you may not have known. And there's this amazing lady who I had an opportunity to represent. Her name was Josephine Wright. I don't know how many of you all saw Josephine Wright, but Josephine Wright was from the Gullah Geechee community along the coast of South Carolina. You familiar with the Gullah Geechee community? She inherited land from her husband, who passed away from New York City, who had family down, and that land had been in their family for 150 years. Now, the interesting part about Josephine Wright is she's one of the strongest women I've ever met in my life. And she was every bit of 4'11". And so when we did our first press conference, she was standing beside me, and you really couldn't see both of us in the picture. I'm about 6'5", and so they would clip the top of my head off just to get her full body in the picture. But this land that she had, developers from Savannah, they wanted her property, actually, to be honest with you. I believe they only wanted about 21 feet of her property. And so they sued her, like many people, particularly black folk throughout the South, and heirs property and losing your land and losing the little bit of wealth you may have. And so here she was at 94, 93 years old, in the last few years of her life, fighting to keep her property. So I joined that battle with her. We were able to mobilize around the world. It was a weird thing. I just found her in a story that was posted on Twitter. I think Twitter's gone all hell now, but there is apparently a glimmer of goodness in it. And I reached out to her granddaughter, and I went down there and met with her, and we went and ate some seafood and hung out together. And I said, "Miss Josephine, I'll do whatever you want me to do," because she reminded me of every black grandmother I had ever seen in my life. And the last thing I wanted her to be doing at 90 years old was fighting. Ironically enough, Miss Josephine Wright passed not too long ago. After she passed, though, we settled her case. And so her family's able to keep her land. But we talk about Josephine Wright and parallel that with the fact that even at 90 years old, being black in this country, you still are fighting. And so that is how we kind of lay this out. And so the first moment was my dad's picture from in front of the South African embassy. The second moment was me. I recall being on TV. It was back when Alison Camerota and John Berman were the host of CNN This Morning. And we, uniquely enough, this was the time period where I still wasn't wearing pants on TV because it was during the middle of COVID. So you just either wear some boxers or pajama pants or whatever, and you got on a full shirt, tie, and jacket. But you can wiggle your toes, right? And my kids were asleep in my wife's bed. My twins, they would oftentimes, we would get them and put them in our bed in the early parts of the morning. And I had a young teenage daughter who was upstairs. And my face was full of hair, and my head was full of hair as well. Don Lemon says that I used to look like a young Teddy Pendergrass. And I won't forget it. I'm a really emotional person. And the interview segment prior to mine was Felonious Floyd and Ben Crump. And Felonious is a good friend of mine now, but that's George's brother. And I lay out the conversation that they were having, and I recall John Berman then coming to me and asking me about how I felt. And I was just so consumed with emotion, because here I was in this home filled with black children. And the images of Stokely actually juxtapose with George Floyd, and trying to figure out how I was going to raise these children in a world that could treat George with such inhumanity. And better yet, not give him the benefit of his humanity. It really bothered me, and so I began to cry. And I began to cry and try to talk through it, and I'm one of those weird criers that my voice gets kind of high-pitched. And when I got off TV, it went viral. It got 20, 30 million views on YouTube and Twitter, but basically what I was trying to do, and I don't even know if I did it really well through the tears, was articulate the pain that was a black experience at that time. So that's moment number two that we talked about. And I have a unique theory about George Floyd. I'll share it with you. I talk about it in here. But George Floyd was, there are two things. The first, God works in really mysterious ways. Because I don't think anybody would have taken George Floyd's resume and said that he would be the person to spearhead a global movement. It's something about the least of these. If you've ever seen me drink tequila, you know I'm the furthest thing from a minister, but you guys have read enough scripture to know what I'm trying to say. The second thing is that, which ties into some of my thoughts in this book, the second thing, which is probably more important, is it took the audacity of a 17-year-old young girl to videotape this. It took a knee in the back of a neck for 9 minutes. It took somebody, a grown man literally yelling out for his mother And then it took for y'all to be in COVID. I postulate that George Floyd would not have been the moment that it was if we were not in COVID. And people logically ask, what are you talking about? Why? Because you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't get back to your daily task. You were forced in your homes to watch this image over and over and over and over again. And then the world had to come out. And I think about all of those things. I think about this young girl filming it. I think about a knee in the back of the neck. I think about COVID. I think about the world coming out. And then and only then could this family get accountability. All of those things had to happen. That's about like getting a royal flush on the flop. All of those things had to happen just for accountability, not justice. Justice is George Floyd still being here. But all of those things had to happen for accountability. It talks about the price that is paid in this country so that we can have a modicum of achievement. But we walk through those moments. We walk through George Floyd, and we walk through COVID. We talk about and examine the lessons that were not learned in COVID. One of the questions that we analyze, my good friend Garland Gilchrist is the lieutenant governor of the great state of Michigan. He's a bad man. He's like 6'7". He's really cool. But during COVID, he lost 25, 26 relatives and close friends. It decimated his entire community. And I think about COVID from a perspective that the groups of people that were affected the worst from both a public health and economic health standpoint were Black folk and Native Americans. And I really think, again, about this moment that wasn't. I really think we never peel back the layers of the onion. So ask Bakari, say, Bakari, why were Black folk and Native Americans the most decimated group by COVID? It's a question that we never asked. Well, I'm from Denmark, South Carolina. What does that mean? That means I grew up in a food desert, which means I can't go, what is it, 1 or 2 miles? I think the USDA has it about 2 miles now without access to fresh fruits and vegetables. That means that you have really high incidence of preventable diseases like diabetes, or as we call it down south, the sugar. Y'all know what that, y'all, okay. Or cardiovascular disease, and why is that? Because you're eating nothing but the cheap processed meats, or you can get the 10 packs of Kool-Aid for $2, and then you get a pound of sugar, and that lasts you for a good week. Where I grew up and we lost our hospital, mainly because we didn't expand Medicaid, like a lot of poor rural hospitals. When you lose your hospital, that's unfortunately a lot of people's place for primary health, so you don't have access to health care. And then our water systems and infrastructure were so bad that they began to utilize a contaminant to clean the water, which means that our water now is less potable than Flint, Michigan. So you have a community that doesn't have access to healthy alternatives, which doesn't have access to health care, which is drinking unclean water, and then you overlay a pandemic. It's no wonder that you are more likely to die or be harmed from that pandemic. But we never really peeled back the layers of the onion, therefore we never addressed the underlying systemic issues which led to that. And the alternative was with my good friends in Washington, some of my good liberal friends in Washington who have blind spots the size of a canyon, decided that you could pass race-neutral policy to effectuate race-specific problems. That drives me completely crazy. There's no more perverse words in politics than colorblindness. And I talk about that as well. But COVID was just a moment in which we missed that opportunity. And so the historical aspects of my father's struggle, and I talk about that because I dedicate this book to my children and my nieces and nephews, and I dedicate this book to the founders and members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. My dad was one of the founders of SNCC, and I grew up in this really unique, rich experience where I was a product of the proverb, it took a village to raise a child. My village was just probably cooler than yours because it had people like Uncle Jesse in it, or Jesse Jackson. It had Julian Bond. It had Kathleen Cleaver in it, and Judy Richardson. It had Marion Barry, who's the greatest mayor in the history of the United States of America. It had all of these people who I don't let anybody talk bad about Miriam. It had all of these people in this village who poured so much into me, and I like to share their stories and lift them up. But then we talk about what I call white terror, and it's two parts. My father was on a unique journey in SNCC. My father, the unique thing about my father is that he's a part of the Emmett Till generation, and he believes that the strongest woman that ever lived was Mamie Till. Because in 1955, Mamie had an open casket for her son, Emmett. And back before you could go viral on Snapchat or Twitter, you went viral in what? Ebony Magazine. And that picture made it in Ebony Magazine. And it spurred my dad's activism. And my dad actually, my grandparents wanted my dad to get out of the movement. And so they sent him to Howard University, which makes sense to nobody. And then the problem, when he got to Howard, guess who his roommate was and best friend? Stokely Carmichael. Stokely graduated from Howard, convinced my dad to drop out of school. He did. He dropped out of school, joined SNCC, and he went to Miami University of Ohio, where they were having training before they went to Freedom Summer down in Mississippi. And I talk about white terror in the first chapter of 1964, and I talk about my dad's search for his friends who had gone missing. My dad was searching for the bodies of Goodman, Schroener, and Cheney. And we talk about just that state-sanctioned violence that was allowed, whether or not you're talking about Medgar, or whether or not you're talking about Emmett, or whether or not you're talking about Goodman, Schroener, and Cheney. You know, you think about the trials of the young people who killed these individuals and how they were all found not guilty if they were tried at all. You think about the brutality in which they were killed, and you think about the nobility of their cause. Goodman, Schroener, and Cheney were literally just trying to register voters in little Philadelphia, Mississippi. And this book has a lot of compare and contrast in it because I contrast that to White Terror Part 2, and it talks about a case that I worked on called the Andrew Brown case. Andrew Brown was a fascinating case because for a period of time, about 3 days, it was the most popular story in the entire world. In little Pasquotank County, North Carolina. He was a client of mine who the police came and tried to serve a warrant, and he backed up and drove away, and they shot him in the back of the head with assault rifles. Some of you all may remember it, and some of you all may not, and part of the reason is because it's just another name or another hashtag. And these chapters kind of run together because it's talking about the violence that is still perpetrated against a lot of black bodies today. And I didn't mention it in the book because I don't think that we were there yet, but I mentioned Dan earlier. Dan and I had the amazing opportunity to represent a young man named Lionel Dotson. And Lionel lost family members in the MOVE bombing. But that ain't where Lionel's story ends, because y'all do some weird stuff up here in Pennsylvania. The city and the University of Pennsylvania actually hid from Lionel his family's bones from the bombing, and not only hid them, but paraded them around at UPenn and raised money and let students take them home and did not, all this time, I think the best way to say it, Dan, you tell me if I'm wrong, is they did not allow this family to rest in peace. And so we have an opportunity to represent him, and it all ties into this ability for this kind of devaluing. And I said something earlier, and I mentioned it on TV a lot, but it's about giving people the benefit of their humanity. And so we tie in those things as well, and we talk about just the ongoing difficulty that we have dealing with that terror. And then we talk about in this book the monetization of racism. Because I'm old enough to remember in my 39 years of great wisdom when racists used to stay in their shadows and not come outside. And I argue that now we see this racism in a mainstream fashion where people are actually on TV talking about the great replacement theory, where Tucker is able to say and do, and Clay Travis are able to say and do, and whatever they feel. I challenge individuals, particularly white male evangelicals, to have to do more if this country is going to ever change. But one of the reasons that I believe that now this has become more popular and utilized as currency is because there is a mechanism now where you don't have to have a hood or a sheet with your eyes cut out. You can just simply wear a Brooks Brothers suit and you can be on talk radio during drive time. Or you can have your own primetime TV show. And then last but not least, I talk about the untapped power of black men in this book. And I'm so engaged in the conversations that we should be having around black men and listening to them and talking about the fact that the second largest demographic voting for Democrats in this country has been black men, and black women deserve their flowers for being number one. But we've ignored this segment of the population for a long time. We've ignored the pain that they go through having to provide and be head of household, their contributions to community, and instead just having to live a life of being put upon often. I challenge the black church in this book, so I don't know if your preacher's gonna like me a lot. That's all right, though. Bishop Jakes calls me every other night. I have three friends that I like to say they give me my guidance. One is Tyler Perry. Tyler's awesome. When I was going through Josephine Wright, the young lady who was losing her home, I called Tyler and said, "You won't believe this amazing lady. Look at this work that I'm doing." And Tyler said, "Okay." And lo and behold, Tyler built this woman a whole new house on her property. I talk to Ayala Vanzana a lot. She's great because I have really bad anxiety. And Ayala is somebody who talks to me often. And she says, anxiety is when my thoughts are in my head without adult supervision. And then I talk to Bishop Jakes a lot, and he gives me my spiritual nourishment. And I talk about him in the book a little bit, but even more importantly, I generalize and overgeneralize the black church purposefully. I know the AME church does great work, but I just say the black church and many churches to this day have moved to a gospel of prosperity and not one of a grassroots activism and bringing communities out the doldrums of where they were and moving them towards a future that is brighter. And last but not least, my favorite chapter in this book is a letter to my son, Stokely. It's entitled, "Dear Stokely." My son's name is Stokely. I'm assuming you know who he's named after. I got the country's little names on my five-year-old twins. Now, you're going to know they're from South Carolina when you hear their names, Sadie and Stokely. Them ain't no city names right there. But Sadie and Stokely are my heroes. And one of the things I wanted to do was be able to articulate to Stokely where he comes from. And in that chapter, I lay out who his grandfather is and grandparents were and who his great-grandparents were. And I try to walk him through the pages of history to let him know that he too can be strong and contribute to society. And it's not just a chapter to my son, because you know in the church we have this saying, you have to stand in the gap. But it's a chapter that you can kind of swap out a few names and read it to every little boy in your community who may need somebody to be that figure. And give them just a little bit of hope about tomorrow. And last but not least, my favorite part of writing any book is the epilogue. Most writers won't tell you that. Or the afterword. It's the best thing. Because your writing can sit for a while, and then you can put a nice bow on it. And so afterword, in every chapter we try to give a prescription because we feel like we do a really good job of identifying problems but not a good job of identifying ways to move forward. And so we try to identify a prescription of how to move forward. And in the final chapter of this book, you know how comedians go to like small venues to try out material before they get to the big, you know, hour-long special? Well, I like to go to Applebee's. I go sit at happy hour at Applebee's, and I go to the one in Columbia, South Carolina, that's right across from the Veterans Hospital. So we get a cast of characters in there all the time. And I go to Applebee's because they pour good liquor. Like, they pour liquor like it ain't their own. You know, you go to some, like, I'm at this nice hotel across the street, and they just pour a little bit of liquor, like, in a little thing. But at Applebee's, they pour it, right? Like, they not taking the bottle back with them. And I was speaking to a bartender, and I said, well, how old are you? And she said, I said, what year were you born? She said, I was born in 2000 and. I was like, there's more? And I began to think about this, and I honed this at Applebee's, and then it made it into the book because I thought it made good sense. But what gives me hope is that a child born in 2000 has lived through 9/11, a housing crisis, financial crisis, the election of the first black president, creation of the Tea Party, re-election of the first black president, Parkland, Fort Hood, a Jewish synagogue murder, the largest mass shooting in the history of the country in Las Vegas, Nevada, a Charleston massacre. They've lived through October 7th. They've lived through a war in Gaza right now. They lived through Russia invading Ukraine. They've lived through a pandemic. They've done all of this under the auspices of January 6th. I forgot about January 6th. They lived through January 6th. They've done all of that under the auspices of social media and the comment section and the cesspool that is social media. And they're still here. I think this generation deserves a little bit more grace than we give them. And so I play with the word grace in the afterword and say that we have to give these young people a little bit more grace. And we have to give ourselves more grace as well. And so I'm hopeful about tomorrow. And my challenge for this country is that I just want her to be better tomorrow than she was yesterday. And with that, let's take some questions. Thank you. There are microphones in the hallways, right, in the aisleways. And the only thing I'll remind you is that questions have question marks.
Bakari, welcome to Philadelphia. My name is Morgan E. Wilson, Jr. My lovely wife next to me had the pleasure of interviewing you last week on, she replaced.
Oh, we had fun. Thank you guys
yeah,
so
yeah,
much.
Doc, yes, Dr. R.G. Allen Wilson on.
Yes. Yes. I was in Mexico looking at the water.
Yes, on for Senator, State Senator Vincent Hughes. You sort of mentioned a little bit about black men, and I'm just curious your take on what's happening in terms of black men, in terms of the voting, and what's happening with them that are, I guess, considering Trump. So I'm just curious about what your take is on.
I don't think that the premise that we're seeing played over and over again about black men voting for Trump in some number that is in the high teens is quite accurate. But I also don't think the analysis whereby we look at this election is accurate either. And I actually think I talked about it on the show. But when you analyze this race is not about Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. And people who look at it that way have an antiquated idea of what elections in this country are. This election is about Donald Trump, Joe Biden versus the couch. And the couch is a very successful candidate because it don't run no ads. But more and more people choose the couch these days than having to vote for either one of them. And so the challenge for Joe Biden is not necessarily, because this isn't a persuasion election. Some elections are persuasion elections. When you have novelty candidates and when you have new candidates, when you have new ideas, new issues, many times you have to persuade a voter to vote for you. This is a GOTV race, plain and simple. And the problem that we're having is that we have two candidates who have a hard time articulating what the future should be. Now, they are very different in a number of ways. But the only similarity I see between the two is that they have a hard time telling me what the vision of the future should be. And you can say that is because of age or what have you, but I would disagree with that and just say that they're not honed in on that in particular at this moment. I think a lot of times my friends on the left, my Democrats, including Joe Biden, I'm very, very, very close, and I just have to throw this out there. One of my best friends in the world is the Vice President of the United States of America. I love her with all my heart. But we get caught up in this subject verb Trump instead of telling people what you have done for them and what you will do for them. And so I was asked the question yesterday to answer your question specifically. The President of the United States is going to my alma mater for homecoming. He's going to Morehouse College. And they asked me, some friends close to the White House said, if the president could talk about three things, what would he talk about? I said, well, the first is just for a lot of us, the world seems to be on fire. Let's just give me a global perspective and outlook on what that looks like going forward. I said, number two, you got to talk about abortion and the role that men play in making sure that we protect reproductive rights for women. I said, number three, you need to talk about an agenda that incorporates voting rights and making sure that we replenish the Voting Rights Act and all these other things. And then I said, I will tell you this, if he gets up there and talks about criminal justice reform as if that's the only thing black folk care about for 25 minutes, I'm going to riot myself. So I think they got the message, but that is what I hope he tells an audience full of young African-American men. Oh, yes, sir.
Hi, Bakari. Thank you so much for coming to Philly, and thank you for your notes on grace for young people as well. I wrote a question in my notes because I don't like taking up time when I'm asking a question during these Q&As. You mentioned your father protesting apartheid. In light of the violent tactics by police we see being used against student protesters exercising their First Amendment rights, including tasings, use of batons, rubber bullets, and even military technology, in conjunction with mass graves of handcuffed Palestinians executed or buried alive by the IDF over the last couple days, these mass graves have been discovered. One, this is kind of a two-part question. One, do you agree with American police officers being trained in Israel? And two, do you agree with the proposed militarized police training facility in Atlanta known as Cop City? And do you agree with authoritarian weaponization of police against students on college campuses?
You just went around. I didn't know where you were going to end up. You sound like Chris Cuomo with that question. I know where you're...
And you mentioned your experience with MOVE, with the MOVE bombing, which was
let me be extremely clear. You asked a very nuanced question, and so I want to be extremely clear with my language here. First and foremost, I have a hard time with police and militarized police and National Guard on college campuses, period. Okay? I just fundamentally do. I think that that's not conducive to having healthy dialogue and conversation. I think our country's learned from that history, whether or not it's South Carolina State, Jackson State, or Kent State. I have a huge problem with militarizing police and putting them on college campuses. I think that's first, and I think you can articulate that. I also think on college campuses, we've had a rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses that has to be acknowledged as well. And I think that we have to root out anti-Semitism at its root. I think people have to be comfortable in protesting. I think that people have to be comfortable in their survival. And I think that all of those things must go hand in hand. I think you can also say or question the use of force that's been after October 7th by Bibi Netanyahu. I think it's extremely fair to question whether or not it was a disproportionate use of force. You can ask those questions. I have no issue with that whatsoever. Cop City, how do I feel about Cop City? I don't really know enough about Cop City, but I do believe that there are a couple of things we should do when it comes to law enforcement. And I'm extremely clear about that. The first thing we have to do is do things like ban chokeholds. The second thing we have to do is make sure that we are eliminating no-knock warrants between the hours of 12 and 6, because it's particularly in the South, if you knock on somebody's door, you come in somebody's house at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're probably going to get shot, and that means that innocent people will get shot as well. I represent a young lady named Latoya James who was killed that way. I think third, we need to have a database for bad officers, because right now if an officer gets fired here in Philadelphia, he can go and get hired in Yardley. I think that's completely unfair and unright. I think fourth, I think that you should have a psychological evaluation for officers when they get hired, and you should have a psychological evaluation for officers every 2, 3, 4 years, okay? And so I think that all of those things are fair. When you look at Columbia to kind of bring it back home, or you look at NYU, I think that you go to college so that you can have a robust exchange of ideas. I think that you go to college so that you can have an unvarnished opportunity to learn as much as you want to. What we're seeing right now is decently unrecognizable, and it's a flashback to a past which we don't want to go. And I do think, I said this to Eric Adams, I do think having law enforcement on college campuses is just a bad recipe. It's a recipe for disaster. We have to make sure, however, in the same breath, that we're protecting all students no matter what they look like, who they pray to, who they love. And I think you can find that balance. Dean Jelani Cobb is somebody I love and adore. He's the dean of the journalism school at Columbia. He's somebody who is actually working to make sure with students that you're having these discussions. He's working with students who are standing with Palestinian students, as well as Jewish students. They're having these conversations in rooms that we don't really know about. These conversations are being had that we don't know that they're being had. And so my hope and goal is that we can get back to a space where you can have those conversations without being persecuted, shouted down, or put upon. And the last thing I'll say is, look, October 7th was one of the, hearing the stories, reading the stories, looking at the women who were assaulted, looking at the women who were killed, looking at the people who were kidnapped who still have not been returned. Devastating. The innocent lives that have been lost in Gaza, whether or not you were a food worker, a mother, a child, a pregnant woman, a clergy, a church member, whatever it was, is devastating. I really pray that there is a cessation of fire. I pray that we have peace. And I pray that no more innocent lives have to be lost. I pray that these hostages are alive and able to get back to their families. And I pray not one more child in Gaza is killed. And that may not sit right with all of you all, but I'm going to have my prayer for peace. And I'm going to live comfortably as such.
Hi.
Hey.
My name's Latay Johnson. I'm an educator in Philly.
These lights hot up here. Good. Y'all got your electricity work.
Fortunately, we won't be too long, okay? I just want to ask one question. You mentioned leadership a lot, particularly a generation of leadership that was stripped from Black America.
Sure.
How would you go about suggesting that we rectify that generation of leadership that we've kind of been, robbed of is like loaded language, but that's the first thing that comes to mind.
I just think the way we teach leadership in this country is perverted. I think we teach leadership in a mechanism whereby you are a leader and it's denoted by how many followers you have. But leadership begets other leaders. And I think that we just fundamentally don't teach leadership in the right way. I do think, to your point, however, when you look at policy, which has been violent, I believe policy can be violent as well. The way that we educate children in this country is violent. The way that we've taken a whole generation of Black men out of their homes due to over-criminalization or hyper-criminalization has been violent. And I think that violence also has had an entire generation of young people who were raised without some type of leader or father figure in their respective communities. How can we replace that? I mean, I think that it's incumbent upon the young men and women in this room, again, to stand in the gap. I don't see that many young Black men, but I see my friend over here who just asked the question. It's incumbent upon all of us. I said, you young at heart. But it's incumbent on all of us to be there and reach out for those who don't have that type of leader. But I would fundamentally start by the way that we teach leadership in our communities.
Hi. Can you say a few words about the disparity of healthcare in the U.S. and how that contributes to keeping people in poverty? And the reason I ask that, I'm a retired school teacher from Savannah. And what I saw in my career were children that would come in, they would miss school because they had to take care of their siblings, or they would come in sick and their heads would be down because they felt terrible, or they would be in the school nurse's office. So basically, you wound up with generations of children that were undereducated. With the advent of Obamacare, one hoped that that would have leveled the playing field. People could take preventative care. You could get your kids to the doctor in a timely manner. However, many states saw fit not to extend Medicaid, yep. And as a result, the gap continued. Can you talk
yeah,
to
Yeah, I mean,
that?
We have fundamental inequities in our healthcare delivery system. So I have three unique ways in which I look at our healthcare system from personal experience. The first is On January 7th, at about 10 o'clock in 2019, we were had a lactation nurse in our room when the twins were born. And my wife began to say she felt hot. And she threw up and passed out. And when we pulled back the sheet, her bed was covered in blood. She lost 7 units of blood, and I think that they say somebody her size has about 9 units of blood in them. I had to be the loudest advocate I've ever been in my life, running up and down the hallways trying to get somebody, because fundamentally nobody listened to her say she wasn't feeling well for a long period of time. She ended up having to have emergency surgery. We had to FaceTime our doctors. We had 3 black female doctors, and we called them, and one of the doctors had an 8-year-old. We were FaceTiming, and she said, well, I've called the babysitter. The babysitter's on the way. My daughter's asleep. I'm going to leave the garage door open, and I'm just coming straight to the hospital. And so all 3 of them got there. They performed emergency surgery on my wife, and they inserted into her, ironically enough, what's called a Bakri balloon. My name is Bakari, B-A-K-A-R-I. A Bakri balloon is B-A-K-R-I. And it's a balloon that they put inside you, and it swells. They pump it up, it swells to stop the bleeding. And she spent the first 36 hours of our children's life in ICU. I tell you that story because black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than their white counterparts. And the unique part about it is it cuts across socioeconomic levels. So whether or not you're middle class, burgeoning upper class, Serena Williams has the same story as the person on Medicaid. And that actually goes to a lot of the structures and implicit biases we have. And so that's one. 2 is I grew up in a community where we lost a hospital because we didn't expand Medicaid and because we were just decently impoverished. And when you lose a hospital, many people don't know that that is, like I said, a lot of people, unfortunately, their primary go-to for healthcare. Because you should actually get physicals instead of waiting until you get sick enough to go to the hospital, but that's a whole nother story. But what you don't realize, and what we have to begin to do when we're thinking critically about these issues, is that when you're in a poor community and you lose your hospital, you also lose probably your largest or second largest economic engine in your county. Because what you got around a library, around a hospital, you got restaurants, you got a florist, you got a motel, you got a pharmacy or two, and all of those things dry up when you lose your hospital. And so you talk about the devastation and the ripple effect of that. And then 3 is something a little bit more nuanced, but when my daughter was 2 years old, Sadie, when she was 2, she was diagnosed with biliary atresia, which is a very rare liver disease. By the time she was 2 months old, by the time she was 4 months old, she was in end-stage liver failure. And she went on the liver transplant waiting list. And we waited 93 days, and we finally got a liver for my daughter. She had a liver transplant at 10 months old. And so I learned a lot about the fact that only 5% of donors in this country are African American. That's to y'all black folk in the audience. I learned a lot about the access to care, and I learned a lot about the access to post-transplant care, because it's a system set up that, and they're trying to change it, but it's a system set up that you really cannot get an organ if you can't take care of it. Because they're so difficult and such a valuable commodity that they will not give you an organ if you don't have the ability to take care and pay for the meds and be able to eat healthy and do all of these things. One of the people, we were at Duke University, and I'll never forget this. We started a fund in Sadie's name. We raised a lot of money for young, particularly black and brown families, but poor families who were going through transplants. And the reason being is because there was a kid in there getting a transplant, and when he got released from the hospital, he and his family were going to the Ronald McDonald House. And for me, I just fundamentally did not believe that that was a recipe for success. I thought that was decently inefficient as a system. because that young boy was probably going to be right back in the hospital from the inability financially to be able to take care, provide the medicines, get the foods and everything he needed. And so from those three perspectives, my view personally on our healthcare delivery system is that it's fundamentally broken. And Obamacare did a great deal to remedy that, but we still have so far to go.
Sir, just wanted to say that for someone who travels as much as you do, you've got some pretty tight edges. I have to give you credit for that.
Thank you. I'll tell Tremaine that.
So, you know, your father obviously grew up in a geographic location, where he was subjected to the Southern civil rights philosophical approach. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that, you know, by virtue of him traveling to, going to school at Howard, and in the time he spent with Stokely, I suspect that he probably has thoughts about different thoughts or different philosophies by other activists, such as Malcolm X. Did he ever share those thoughts with you? And the last question is, how did you become a CNN commentator?
So the two points, and yes. My father was more along the lines of Marion Julian H-Rap Stokely than he was King. A lot of these individuals kind of learned the struggle in the South. What made SNCC unique is the impression that black women had on the organization. Because I would argue the two greatest movement leaders in the history of the country were Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer. And those were just some badass women. Now, King of the Wilderness is a great documentary. I don't know if you've seen it. But King of the Wilderness highlights the trajectory of both Malcolm and Martin and how their trajectory kind of ended up doing something like this, where they were kind of coming back towards a common point. The problem that I have with the way that King is taught is we teach King as if he was some type of docile individual instead of the rabid revolutionary that he was. I remind people all the time why Dr. King died and when he died and what he was doing. There had been a sanitation worker in Memphis, Tennessee, who was just killed because of the conditions that garbage workers were working in Memphis. And he was there standing on the front lines protesting wages and conditions for sanitation workers. And what I want you to do is think about this man who was one of the greatest men to walk the earth with a Nobel Peace Prize, protesting with people who pick up your trash. That tells you what type of individual Dr. King was. My father was of the firm belief, though, that you don't necessarily turn your other cheek often. He was, if you get punched, you probably got to punch back or they're going to hit you again. That got him arrested a good little bit. I end up in surmise by saying that all of it's necessary. The movement successes don't happen without, you know, the approach of a Ralph David Abernathy and a Dr. King, as well as a Marion Barry and a Stokely Carmichael. I challenge you to read the words of John Lewis at the March on Washington, but I don't want you to read the words that he gave. I want you to read the words that they would not let him give. He had to change his speech the night before. The President of the United States and many others, including Dr. King, were a little bit infuriated by the fierceness of his language. And people grow. And I dare say that if you read the words that he was not allowed to say, and you juxtapose that against the John Lewis you know now, you just say people get older. They learn as they live.
Hi, my name's Alea, and I do want to start off by saying, as a doula, I am very sorry that your wife had to go through such a difficult time, and that somebody as part of your care team wasn't there to advocate for her, because truly, no one should have to deal with that kind of oppression and that kind of distraughtness as they're going through what should be a beautiful moment of bringing life to that world. And on that note, I would ask, knowing what that kind of devastation does to bringing life into the world, how that sits on you and your prayers for Gaza, considering the mounting public health crisis, the tripling in miscarriage rates, the rampant infant mortality, along with the bombing and on-the-ground attacks of every single hospital in the Gaza Strip.
Thank you. I mean, I didn't know if you wanted a response or what, but just thank you for your, I mean, I think that a lot of times as we're having these discussions, we turn a blind eye to people who come from a good place with opinions that we may not share or may not be the same as ours. And I think the only thing I can respond to you and say honestly and truthfully is that I hear you. And there are things that there are things you want me to look at in my worldview, and I can say that I hear you, and every day I'm trying to grow.
My name is Asantua Nkrumah Ture, and I want to say first that I'm very glad to meet you in person. I met your dad, Dr. Cleve Sellers, back in the 1980s, 1990s, and he told a very good story about how he, my brother Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, my big brother Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, Mukasa Willie Ricks.
Mukasa, he's in the picture too.
Yes, he is. I have it on my phone.
Yes, ma'am.
And Ethel Miner, and all the Palestinian students she met when she went to South America. So my question is, your father told a very captivating story about how he was a part of the faction of SNCC that came out in support of Palestine and against Zionism during the 67 war. So my question to you is, respectfully, but still, how is it that your politics regarding Palestine and Zionism and your relationship with AIPAC are the exact opposite of your father and what your father taught me and my generation? Thank you so much.
So I don't know if it's the exact opposite, but what I will tell you is I've actually had the experience, and I think my father appreciates the experience, and I think he appreciates the growth. I've actually been to Gaza. I've been to the West Bank. I've actually been to Israel 4 times. I've been to Lebanon. I've been in a kibbutz that was raided on October 7th. I actually worshipped in 8 with individuals who are no longer here. I will tell you that I fundamentally believe in a two-state solution. I will tell you that I think that we're in a place right now where, as I stated earlier, just in a kind of a brief, not, I don't want to say overlook, but brief sentiment that I believe the world is on fire. I also say this, I mean, I'll be 100% honest with you since we're having this conversation. I believe that the response that we've had from Israel has been disproportionate to what happened, but I'll also tell you, in the same breath, I'll tell you I have a great deal of difficulty tolerating the leadership of Bibi Netanyahu. And in the same breath, I'll tell you that it's very difficult to negotiate with the people who do not believe you should exist. And I'll tell you that as long as Hamas is in power, the things that we want, such as peace, are going to be very, very difficult to accomplish.
Brother, the occupation began in 1948.
Well, we're having a conversation. We're having a conversation about right now, though. I completely understand the history, but who is in power right now? And I mean, I think if we're going to have a real conversation, let's have it. I don't disagree with, disagree with that fact, but you're also talking about it. You're also talking about getting to a place where you can have peace. You're actually talking about getting to a place where you can have a two-state solution. You're also talking about getting to a place where you can have funds that directly go to humanitarian aid, where you can rebuild infrastructure, where you can rebuild hospitals. We're having a conversation about how to get to that place. And my response to you is that if I can understand how critical it is and how necessary it is to be critical of Bibi Netanyahu and his leadership and the conservative regime that runs Israel right now, and be able to talk about those things with some intellectual honesty, it's hard to have a conversation with anybody who says Hamas, but. I'm trying to get to a place where I understand what harm is, where I understand what damage is, but I'm not going to overlook historical facts that have already been, I'm not going to overlook October 7th. I'm not going to overlook those terrorist activities. I'm not going to overlook those things as we try to get to a place where we can rectify those issues and actually have a two-state solution whereby we have people who are able not just to survive but able to thrive as well.
Our interview on Philly Speaks.
Yes, ma'am.
And I thank you for being here.
For sure.
We laughed and joked about the fact that when we're in the city, my family is from Sumter, South Carolina, and Eden, North Carolina.
A little something, something.
Yeah, yeah. And so my main question, and I know you need to have a question mark behind it. I just want to give you the context. I grew up in Philadelphia where my father was a homicide detective. Mm. And I was a little girl watching TV when that bomb was dropped on the house of those MOVE members mm-hmm. on Osage Avenue. And as a little girl, I knew my dad was down here working, and I didn't know if he was coming back home. I also hear the voice of our ancestors that talk about how we have to continue to fight, and the woman that you talked about that continued to fight.
Yeah.
For my dad and many other black men, my husband included, you included, you talked about having anxiety
mm-hmm.
and having a therapist and having even Ayala Vasat talk about the voices in your head being, you know, unsupervised by adults or something like that. And so I'd love for you to speak to the little boy in you.
Yeah.
And the little boy that you have and the adult man that may need to have a safe place to process all of it. Whether that be therapeutic, whether it be spiritual with T.D. Jakes, whoever it is, that little boy or that grown man that often operates in a space where people are not heard, where you're not heard.
I mean, we're talking about generational trauma. You're talking about all of those things and the inability to have outlets to process those things with whatever you're going through. I mean, I joke and say I go to therapy to deal with y'all who don't go to therapy. I mean, that's kind of a fact of the matter. I believe that everybody under the sound of my voice, particularly black men, should be talking to somebody. Let me finish this thought real quick, and then we'll wrap up with you, okay? I feel like we have an empathy deficit in this country, and I feel like it's necessary for us to be able to process the emotions that we're going through on a daily basis. And in particular for black men, I just think it's extremely tough because of the pressures we live with in society. Yes, ma'am. Last question.
And my statement is, first place, this country was built on the backs of black slaves. I'd like to know, what will it take for us to finally stand up and have the courage to stand up and demand that we have the rights that we have earned? What will it take?
I think we've been trying to do that. You know, when people ask me, they say, Bakari, are you for reparations? I say the answer is yes, but what do they look like? You know, I have a hard time believing we're going to get a check in the mail. I do believe we should get to a place where we have policies such as ones that allow black folk to go to school at a state-supported institution for free, like a GI Bill for black folk. I think you said it, though. I don't know if you said it all the way through, but we built this country, but we built this country for free. And there are a lot of people who are still toiling in the vineyard. And so I guess my goal, one of the goals that I have in this country is to say that we don't have any change in this country unless black blood has flowed through the streets. And my goal is to drive down the cost for black folk to have any change so that we don't have to die for that change to be realized. So with all of that, I just say this, with all the questions and with all the audience, with all the people who are here, I love and appreciate you all. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to have dialogue, challenging disagreements, whatever it may be. But I come from a place of love and respect to you all. And so I just want to say thank you for coming out and thank you for spending some time with me. God bless you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.